Hello and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast brought to you by Bruegel, the Brussels European and Global Economic Laboratory that makes sense of today's key issues for Europe and beyond. I'm Solène Honorine. It's already summer, a summer without music festivals, without big weddings, but a summer nonetheless. COVID-19, for the moment at least, seems to be cutting us some slack. So, as usual, Europeans are starting their tourism migration towards the sun and the beaches of South Europe. To help preempt a second wave, several EU countries are betting on technology, but the large mix-up of people can make epidemic control even more difficult. Today, we'll look at the COVID-19 apps, not strictly from an epidemiologic point of view, because that's not Bruegel's specialty, but from an economic and regulatory perspective. Because the way various apps have been developed and rolled out across Europe tells its own story about some limitations of the single market integration in the continent. So for this, I'm joined with Bruegel fellow Scott Marcus, who's a specialist in policy and regulatory issues related to electronic communications. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And Nicolas Potier, trade specialist and particularly interested in e-commerce. Hi, Nicolas.
Hi.
So first of all, Scott, can you first explain to us how the various apps and contact tracing technologies have been rolled out in Asia?
Asia has taken a very different approach to those contact tracing apps than what we've tended to do here in Europe. In Asia, they were rolled out aggressively in countries like China, Korea, Taiwan, and they've been very effective. But they've been very effective in a way that was closely integrated with manual contact tracing and with imposition of enforced quarantines or isolation. So it was part of an integrated program. Also, it was integrated with a lot of other data. The apps weren't used alone. They were integrated with immigration or travel data. They were integrated with, in some cases, credit card data. They were integrated with health data. Used in that way, they seem to have been very effective in South Korea and in Taiwan in particular, and also in China. But it's going to be a different implementation here in Europe.
So what actually does the landscape look like in Europe?
What we're seeing now is a rollout of applications in different countries. France and Germany have gotten a lot of press, but we see applications in other places like Norway. We see attempts to roll out in the UK. Like so many things in Europe, it's kind of a patchwork quilt. It's a mix in different countries using different technologies. A number of the European member states will probably take the Android or Google and Apple implementation, which is based on so-called Bluetooth capabilities in the mobile phone, and we'll do that using a widely distributed technology that most people, me included, think is a good technology or promising technology. Other countries have taken different approaches. France used an approach that's much more centralized, potentially a bit more intrusive on privacy. But it's been reviewed by privacy advocates in France, and they think it's reasonably okay. I would say it's reasonably okay as long as you trust the government, which I think for France is probably okay. The differences, though, are important, and the fact that we have different implementations in different countries could be a big deal. For all of these systems, it's really important that as many people as possible take them up. If I'm sitting in a bar and the person who's sitting a little too close to me turns out a few days later to be infected, I want to know that. But I'm only going to know that if he was using the same app that I'm using and if his app is registering the information in the same country that my app is registering the information.
We would want to unpack this and understand actually the reasons why in Europe, which after all, we've been told is a single market. This is a continent where we are quite integrated in our economies. We have institutions that work. We're supposed to talk to each other. And so we will, during this podcast, try to understand why this is not the case by taking the example of the COVID-19 apps. Nicolas, as a specialist of trade and e-commerce, could you quickly draw the portrait of the limitations right now of cross-border trading in Europe in the digital space?
I think the picture that's got used, this quilt, is very, very nice picture of where we are at the moment. So our experience of the internet is actually that normally we can access almost every news, every web page. We can read a lot of content and a lot of free content online. But then if you go to the internet and you actually want to purchase things, or you want to look at movies or this kind of things, it's actually a very different experience. You suddenly experience a lot of frontiers that are not in line with our normal experience of the internet. And I think part of this is because actually most parts of the internet, we don't purchase anything. We don't do any kind of purchase or a commercial transaction. If you go to a free news web page, you don't pay for that. Actually, someone pays, that's the advertisement company, but you as a consumer don't pay. But actually, then if you go to the commercial side of things, then it's actually still services and goods that are sold in specific marketplaces, and the specific marketplaces have different regulations. And that's kind of the reason of the fragmentation to some extent of the single market. It's not really a fragmentation necessarily of the digital sphere itself. It's actually that most services that we purchase are regulated at a national level. And as long as we have the national regulations, there's kind of boundaries of purchasing cross-border. This is not necessarily the case with these COVID-19 apps, which, again, is not a transaction you do. But still, there is kind of a national government looking for a solution for their country, developing solution that works. And there's a restriction, but there's not the institutional capacity, I would say, to actually, it's not the first thought to think what that means, how we can integrate that. And now there is an initiative by the European Commission to integrate these, to have interoperability between these apps. But we don't know how long that will take until this is operational. In Germany, they have an app since a month ago now. In Belgium, we might wait until autumn until we have an app. Is this a product that is already developed, that is proven that it works? It's this piece of software that would be from a technical standpoint, it would be no problem to scale it up, to just say, kind of roll the same thing out in Belgium, but that is not happening. There's still a Belgian government developing their own solution. And I think this is kind of a bit of a symbolic to the difficulties or the challenges we have in the digital single market.
Well, in fact, with the summer coming, if I understand correctly, if I'm a German tourist in Mallorca, I'm going to a bar, and a few days after I test positive to COVID-19, I have the app. The other German tourist who also have the German app and who was, let's say, 2 meters from me in the bar might receive a message. But the Spanish girl I've been talking to for the whole evening, could she also get the message that she had been in close contact with someone who tested positive?
There are really two issues here. The first one is, do the apps detect one another? The second is, where does the report go when the person tests positive? As far as the apps detecting one another, that'll probably only happen if they're using very much the same technology. Several countries are probably going to use the Google-Apple technology. There's a real possibility that those apps could recognize one another. The second question is, where does the report go? For me, as a German, my app is going to report to the Robert Koch Institute in Germany. If a Spanish person eventually has a Spanish app, it's probably going to report to Spanish health authorities. And unless those two health authorities are pooling data, which probably under European privacy rules requires my informed consent, unless the reports are going to the same place, there's no possibility of exchanging information. So I think we have a real problem here as long as we have separate applications.
This may be a naive question, but shouldn't it have been from the start a concern, especially for countries that share so much movements of people, considering that this is a pandemic that doesn't know any borders?
I certainly would argue that it should have been a concern from the first, but we live in a European Union that isn't really a union. Now, I was born in the United States. We had, in the 1780s and 90s, we had something called the Articles of Confederation. And under those articles, the various states delegated only certain powers to central authority and kept all the rest for themselves, very similar to what we have in the European Union today. What became the United States gave that up as a bad job in only 10 years. For us, we do not have a consensus in Europe to move to a federal system. And one could say rightly so, but we've chosen a different path, and it has implications. There are many areas: public health, education and training, social protection of workers, defense, security. All of those are areas where the member states have primary responsibility, and the European Union has at most only a supporting role. And as a result, we have a very fragmented response that unfortunately means that the Spanish girl that we were speaking to in the bar probably won't find out that we've reported to German health authorities that we have a problem.
We have seen the same in the area of trade, with the export restriction that were put into place at some point by Germany and France of protective equipment at a moment where this protective equipment was not produced or was mainly produced within the European Union by Germany and France, and this, and there was an emergency in Italy. I don't think there are cynical reasons for the restrictions. I don't think there was someone in Germany saying, actually, we don't care about the Italians. I think it's more that basically the institutional capacity are German politicians and bureaucrats and functionaries taking decisions given the institutional environment in which they are in, given for the people that they ever voted for. And it's not their role to think about what's happening in other countries.
There is something a little bit ironic in a way in the distribution of tasks. Scott, you were explaining that the main technical work was done by Apple, Google, right? Who managed to work together in order to make it so that the apps could be interoperable. So private companies who are competitors and are not European were able to work together in order to deliver some public good, but the states were not able to work together? How can we explain that?
Somewhat path dependencies. Different institutions took the lead in different countries. In the UK, I know Oxford University was doing considerable work. I think that their implementation, which they abandoned very recently in favor of the Apple Google approach, originated in a university. The French work was done, again, in research institutions. It's not that these are bad institutions, it's that each one is different. So again, the countries, they had different priorities.
Is that also maybe a symptom of the impossibility in Europe to have big digital champions emerging because we're so fragmented? Or am I going too far if I'm asking this type of question?
I would say it's largely the same issue. Fragmented markets lead to fragmented companies. I think almost every economist who has looked at this believes that the United States and also China have a substantial advantage by virtue of having a fully integrated domestic market that they can use as a first market for their goods and services, which they then sell successfully to the world. Now, the European Union has done a huge amount of work on this for decades, and especially in the most recent legislative term under the aegis of the digital single market. There are many, many disparities among the member states that they have worked to try to improve. Differences in value-added tax implementation, geo-blocking regulations, challenges even in parcel delivery, which of course for e-commerce merchants is a big deal. Differences in consumer protection. Even though we supposedly have horizontal regulations, the member states embellish on these in ways that require the e-merchants to know the rules in every single member state. So there is work that's been ongoing. Supposedly for products, if a product is accepted in one member state for sale, it should be possible to sell it everywhere, except for this, except for that, except for the next thing. There are so many exceptions that the e-merchants can't profit from these mutual recognition rules. So there's been work ongoing for decades. It's actually good work, but there's still a huge amount of difficult work to be done.
It's quite astonishing that a service like Zoom has multiplied by, I don't know what, by a factor, its usage. I mean, it's just mind-blowing how much more hours used the service, not just users, but actually how intensively this product is used. And there was no hiccups, because basically, if you're in the cloud and you have cloud servers, you can actually do that quite quickly. The problem is, if you have regulatory hurdles, how big your market is, that doesn't work. So basically, in US, you can scale your business quite quickly up, especially if it's a business that doesn't have like a foothold in the physical world that much. You can scale it up very, very quickly to 300 million customers. In Europe, the biggest market that you have, the biggest single country that you have is Germany. It's like 80 million customers. It's remarkably smaller.
I would like to go back to what, Scott, you described as really the main issue, which is data management, because in order to prevent the second wave, hopefully, of COVID-19, it's really important to be able to trace contacts, and so therefore having data. And the more data there is, the more efficient the apps would be. And so basically, if there would be a case to be made on some dominance of only one product over the market, then health and COVID-19 could be a good examples to take for that. So Scott, could you go a little more in details about the hurdles in terms of data management in Europe? Is it strictly linked to privacy issue, GDPR type of issue?
The biggest reason why we don't have systems like the Asian systems has to do with privacy concerns, and also relatedly to the fact that the governments aren't about to require people to download and use these applications. About 17% of the German population has downloaded the German app. It does mean if I'm sitting in the bar and the person next to me later turns out to be infected, I've got about a 1 in 6 chance of finding out. And happily, in Germany, we're probably using the same government app. That'll be true for many European countries, thank goodness. But it would be better if it was more. In Norway, it's about 30%. In France, only about 2% have downloaded the app. And due to technical limitations in the implementation, it looks to me like only about half of 1% are using the app at any given time. That means that I've got only one chance in 200 that I will actually be told that this person sitting next to me at the bar has later turned out to be infected. That's not very exciting for me as a French user. So that's the first set of issues. A second is simply that they were all developed using different principles. Some of them were developed in more centralized approaches like the French. The ones based on the Android Apple technology tend to be on a decentralized approach that's probably somewhat better in terms of protecting individual privacy. Those applications probably could be made to work together if somebody wants to take the time to do it, and if we can solve the privacy problems about ensuring that people agree to have their data shared across national borders.
I'm French myself, and there was a lot of debates in France about the privacy issues. If I'm not mistaken, though, all of that has been deemed GDPR compliance. So whether they're centralized or decentralized, those apps are in agreement with European privacy law. So does that mean that the European privacy laws have loopholes, or does it mean that it's more of a cultural thing and Europeans are very touchy about their privacy?
Well, Europeans are sensitive about their privacy, but I believe that the apps that are being developed in Europe today are GDPR compliant. The remaining issue is that because personally identifiable data is centrally stored, it would mean if the French repository of data were hacked, a lot of data could be exposed. That's a danger that appears not to exist with the German system. But as long as you think that the French can do a reasonable cybersecurity job, you shouldn't lose a lot of sleep over that. It was reviewed by the French privacy agency, the CNIL, and they said it was reasonably okay, and I'm inclined to accept that. So the systems are good enough, but the privacy concerns are the reasons why we aren't seeing, for example, close integration between manual tracing and digital tracing. It's why if you find out that you were next to someone who was infected, you won't find out the person's name, and I don't think you're going to find out where you were potentially exposed. which of course raises big questions. I'm told I might have a risk. How can I evaluate that risk if I don't know where it was or with whom?
Could we also say that the limitation we are seeing right now in the interoperability between the COVID-19 app is also something that shows limitations for machine learning, artificial intelligence, and those technologies that require to be fed a lot of data? Or is it going too far to draw this parallel?
I would argue it's going a little too far, but not a lot too far. We do have issues with the use of big data. In terms of the COVID-19 applications that have actually been developed, they're not being integrated with other data for reasons of privacy. So the lack of big data in Europe isn't so much of an issue for them. It's an issue generally. What the European Commission and the European institutions have been trying to do over the last few years is to come up with a coherent set of rules that as much as possible allow non-personal data to be shared while still protecting the privacy rights associated with personal data, personally identifiable data. There are even a couple of specific legal measures that were enacted to try to ensure that public sector data can be as widely used as possible. It actually requires for a large range of public sector applications that the data be made available in real time through application programming interfaces. So it's not a one-sided set of issues where the European institutions simply limit access to all data. They're limiting access to certain data at the same time that they try to open up access to data that doesn't involve problems. We have a European Union, a European single market. It's supposed to be there for goods, services, capital, and people. It works a lot better for goods than for services. It works better for capital than for people. So there's still a lot of work to be done, but I think what we're doing is mostly in the right direction. On GDPR, at the time when it was first being discussed at the political level, many of the digital companies in the U.S. were complaining. There's still echoes of that. But in fact, at this point, most of them have accepted it, and a number of them, I would especially highlight Microsoft here, many of them would argue that they would rather deal with something pretty close to GDPR worldwide than have to deal with different privacy standards in 200 different countries. So at this point, it has been to a large degree accepted as kind of a gold standard for privacy. Variants of it are being adopted in many countries around the world. I would tend to see it not as a failed policy, but rather as a real triumph for European policy. Something that I think is being widely embraced.
I mean, GDPR, it has a lot of flaws, and I think it's maybe too early to really say how effective it is. But I think it is a really important attempt, and it's really successful also in the sense that actually we have here a sector where we really struggle with the fact that Europe is not very competitive in the digital realm compared to American companies. But still, we managed to regulate these companies. And I think we should see that as a success, and we should see this as a way forward. As we have in other parts of trade, where we might not produce the stuff ourselves, but still that doesn't mean we cannot make the rules under which these goods are traded in or sold in the European Union. If you hear the speeches about the recovery fund and how we want to recover, I think the digital economy is always part of this. It's always mentioned as part of the solution, a strong part of the solution. And I think we should embrace that. But it also means that we have to actually answer the difficult questions, the many difficult questions that we have that impede the digital trade that we have at the moment. The reason that we have trouble is actually this fragmentation. I think that is something that the classical tools of fiscal tools that we have of fiscal stimulus and recovery and industrial policy don't really work. I think the key part here is actually not to ponder too much about the GDPR, but actually to think about how can we invest in research and development in the European Union, how can we unify our markets, and how can we integrate the different countries and economies. I think that's the big question we have. And that's actually something that is, I would say, cheap to do economically, because in the end it's regulation, but it's very expensive politically.
So this will be our parting words. Thank you very much, Niklas. Thank you, Scott. This episode of The Sound of Economics was presented and edited by me, Solène Honorine, and brought to you by the economic think tank Bruegel. Thank you for listening wherever you are, and let us know what you think on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn.